Welcome to episode 10 of the Serious About Security podcast for Monday, June 25th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or Sirius, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at Sirius.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP. In today's announcement, we have the next Greater Lafayette Security Professionals meeting coming up on July 12th. In this meeting, there will be a workshop using Metasploit and other tools used for assessing and exploiting virtual environments. Please bring your laptop, an Ethernet cable, and some lunch.
In news, this podcast, we have a few security-related updates. Adobe updated Flash Player on Windows, Mac OS X, Linux, and Android to fix 6 high and 1 medium ranked vulnerability on June 8th. Opera 12.0 was released on June 14th and fixed 3 moderate ranked vulnerabilities. And Oracle updated Java to version 7, update 5, which incorporated 14 security fixes. And for the second podcast in a row, Chrome did not have any security updates.
Okay, the topic for today's podcast will be addressing some topics from our last podcast, and as Keith put it, the week of leaks, where we discussed the password leaks of LinkedIn and eHarmony and Last.fm. So I'll begin by talking about password salting and what makes a good salt, and then Keith will address password hashing methods, and Preston will follow up with password cracking methods. So, as we talked about in our last podcast, LinkedIn had that their database hacked, where all their where I believe it was 6.5 million passwords were revealed, and what made that very easy for those passwords to be cracked is the fact that they had not applied any salting. One way we talked about the fact they can strengthen that was to add a salt. So what is it that makes up a good salt? And one of the things that makes a salt good is the randomness of the salt. And one method for creating random salts is to use a cryptographically secure pseudo-random number generator. And these are number generators which are designed to be cryptographically secure and provide a high level of randomness, which makes the salt very difficult to predict. Now, when it comes to the length of a salt, typically short salts are not very good at all. It's recommended to have a pretty good size length to your salt. One recommendation I found, in fact, said that you could make the length of the salt the same length as the output of the hash function that you're using. So, for example, in the case of SHA-256, which output is 32 bytes, the salt that you use with that could also be 32 bytes. Now, as far as storing the salt is typically stored with the hash, and I've seen this done in a couple different methods. I've seen it stored separately within a database table, but I've also seen it stored within the within the same field that the password hash is stored. And what I found regarding this is it's not so much the secret of the salt. You shouldn't necessarily be worried necessarily about hiding the salt within the database. It's really more, the strength more comes from the randomness of the salt. So it's really more of what's more convenient for you as far as storing it. Personally, I've taken the approach of storing it in the same field with the hash so that it's all stored in one database field instead of two, so that everything I need is right there in that one field. Some tips as far as the salt is already mentioned. You know, it's not a good idea to use a short salt. There's not much additional security if the salt's very short, you know, for example, just one character. It's also not a good idea to reuse a salt. The salt should be used once and then never be reused again, which is where the randomness comes in. And I've also seen recommendations that you should not use salts that are predictable. So, for example, using the username or the email address associated with the user may not be the best thing if the salt can be predicted. Because I think the theory behind that is if I know the username, and for example, we take the LinkedIn example, you know, the database got dumped, everyone went and changed their password. Well, if I know how to create that salt, I know it's the username, and I get a dump of that database again, then I can recreate that salt, and then I can hit it against the hash and see if I can find a match on that password. So it appears that the best technique is to make that salt as random as possible, and that every time the passwords change, the salt is changed as well. So Keith and Preston, what are your thoughts on that?
I think you're right that the randomness is certainly a factor, and you know, often programmers or developers don't choose good sources of randomness, but I think in this case you'd want to choose a good cryptographic or pseudo-random number generator to get the randomness there for the salt you are using. And typically the bigger the salt, the better, the bigger the salt means that you're going to have more possible permutations on a password hash for a given password, which is always beneficial because that favors the developer, where it challenges the attacker, because then the larger the salt, the more permutations they have to generate in order to find that original password.
Well, in my opinion, with salting, especially when you looked at the LinkedIn and eHarmony things, I mean, That was just any salt is better than no salt at all, really. I mean, especially when I'm going to talk about the cracking methods, but I mean, if you choose to salt, you should pick a good salting method, such as long salts, random salts. They should change. If a user changes their password, the salt should change with the password. Otherwise, if they have a table for that particular salt, then essentially them changing the password won't necessarily have any impact on them being able to get their password again. You want to change the salt with the password, which goes into the never reusing a salt. You shouldn't reuse a salt for users, and when somebody changes their password, their salt should change with the password change.
Yes, and I think that's the key. As you mentioned, in the case of LinkedIn, what made it such a wildly successful dump of their password database was the fact that there was no salt. But I think if you're going to go to the trouble of creating the salts, just to be aware of these pitfalls. As Preston mentioned, any salt would have added additional security. However, if it was an easy to predict salt that did not change with the user's password change, over time, that would be much easier to crack than a long random salt, as has been suggested by the article that I reviewed. So if there's no other comments regarding the password salting, I'll go ahead and hand it over to Keith here, and he can discuss the password hashing methods.
So Mike, with his discussion, started us off and suggested some options like using hash algorithms. Cryptographic hash algorithms is one method for using it in generation of the password hash and using that as part of the hash itself. And so one of the issues that comes up is when developers create a new method for hashing, they often overlook some key characteristics that what I would call good properties for password hashing. And these are related to cryptographic hashes, but there's some significant differences that we're also going to talk about. But so the first property is that the original password is not stored in the database. Okay, we don't want to keep that around, obviously. So when we hash it, we don't want to have the original password sitting around anywhere. The password hash cannot be reversed into the original password, meaning that I can't take the hash that's stored in the database and somehow do some magic and reverse it out and get the original password. Another good property is that no two passwords should create the exact same password hash. This is all coming back to the idea of salting a password. So if you have users that choose the exact same password, there aren't going to be hashes that for those two users that are going to be identical. The salt that's used generates a permutation between the two. finally, or not finally, but another one is there exists many possible password hashes for a unique password. And so I could enter the same password many times and still have unique hashes for each one. Also, the creation of the password hash from a password is not computationally fast, nor is it a memory efficient process. When we talk about cryptographic hashes, that would be your MD5s, your SHAs, those types of algorithms. They're designed to be very fast. Typically, in most cryptographic applications, you want high-speed computation. Performance is an issue. When we're talking about password hashing, any method by which we can quickly hash favors the attacker because that allows them to create lookup tables or rainbow tables that are extremely significant in that they would be able to quickly go through the entire possibilities of passwords and generate hashes for each one. We don't want that. We want them to actually spend more time calculating hashes for each password hash. And so having something that's very fast and memory efficient benefits the attacker and not the developer trying to protect this information. So those are some properties here that we want to talk about. And so Mike spent some time talking about salting, which is very, very useful. And my argument is that maybe the idea of trying to create your own password hashes is not the best method. Salting is good if you're taking an existing system and you want to salt passwords and the hashes that you're storing currently. But if you're developing a new system, you may want to look at using a password hash algorithm to do that and not try to invent something on your own. Okay. So cryptographic hashes, as I mentioned, they're designed to be very fast and efficient. They're typically used in your cryptographic applications such as IPsec. And also, because they can be fast, they can be used in hardware-based password cracking systems. So speed is actually the problem in this case. With crypto hashes, they're fast. We don't want that necessarily. So the other end of the spectrum is the idea of a password hash. That is a method by which we encode or encrypt passwords specifically designed for that purpose. And so the password hash is not a cryptographic hash. However, it may use a cryptographic hash algorithm to do that. The hash is going to stretch a password. That's the term used to take a password to make it more resistant to brute force attacks. It does this by increasing the amount of time it takes to actually test each possible key that might be submitted. Password hashing also takes more resources than you would in a standard cryptographic hash. That raises the cost of a brute force attack, causing the attacker to spend more resources and effort to actually generate password hashes to do brute force attacks. So there are a couple methods to do this. One that we'll talk about is the password-based key derivation function. This is described in RFC 2898. Also, it is on RSA Public Key Cryptographic Standard number 5. These were published in the year 2000. And this algorithm takes a pseudo-random function, the password submitted, a 64 or a variable length salt, and then you can set the length that you want it to be in the output. And the pseudorandom function and the length of the derived key can be specified in the function itself. So this gives you flexibility and you can say, well, I want to run it through 1,000 iterations and I want to use a 64-bit salt. And by doing that, you can change it over time if you decide that the password hashing needs to keep pace with the performance changes in computing hardware that's available. You can actually adjust this algorithm and use it to expand the amount of computation required from an attacker point of view. So this system is actually used in a variety of file system encryption and also password storage tools. Another algorithm that was published in 1999 is called bcrypt. This was published by Niels Provost and David Mazares. And it uses Blowfish with a modified key schedule, which and then uses the standard Blowfish algorithm for the actual hashing. So Blowfish has a very significant, if you will, key schedule, which is where you take the cryptographic key that you want to encrypt with and create what are called subkeys. And bcrypt takes this key schedule but also modifies a bit and actually uses the password but also a salt as part of the subkeys used. And then once that is set up, that is used to actually do the hashing part of the algorithm. And it has what's called an adjustable cost to it. And so you can adjust that number in the when you submit a password to be hashed. And it can exponentially slow the performance of the algorithm. And this is done so that you can keep your password hashes resistant to brute force. And so this is actually implemented in the OpenBSD 2.1 crypt function. And it's been part of that system for a while, but it's also been integrated into a variety of other platforms. And there are several software libraries available, especially if you're writing web applications for PHP, Python, Perl, Ruby, those sorts of things. There's lots of libraries available to integrate that. And then another algorithm, which is more recent, in 2009, Colin Percival wrote something called Scrypt. And Scrypt is designed to make hardware-based cracking solutions very expensive, because what it does is it uses memory-hard functions, which require lots of storage and are not easily parallelized. And so this is a way of actually using some amount of memory and choosing random bits within that memory block that's created, and requires more memory than your standard password hash algorithm does. The one downside to Scrypt is we don't have anybody else who's gone back and looked at the original paper that Colin Percival wrote and also done some analysis on the software that he developed. There are libraries available in C and Python, Java and C Sharp and Ruby. So this one is kind of hard to say, do we want to use Scrypt over bcrypt? The problem with Scrypt and bcrypt is there really aren't a lot of academic research out there that's gone back and said, you know, this one's better than that one, and for these reasons. Now, if you look at the performance of these systems, if you run the algorithm through MD5, SHA-1, SHA-512, the performance on a system is very quick. These things are designed to be fast. So when you hash a password using that method, it's going to be quick. If you use bcrypt or scrypt, you'll notice that the amount of time it takes to encode a password in either of those methods, and particularly if you use bcrypt with a higher cost factor, the performance actually goes down significantly, which favors the person that's encoding the password to store in a database, and does not favor at all the attacker who's trying to build a brute force attack against a set of password hashes, for example. And so when we make recommendations, I think we typically want to say, if you're building a new system, use bcrypt at least, scrypt maybe, depending on what your requirements are. These are designed for passwords specifically, whereas cryptographic hashes are not. They're more primitives used in cryptographic systems. And so using a hash designed to handle passwords is probably your best bet, because we don't want good performance per se. That favors the attacker in this case. We want to make sure that it takes a while to actually generate the hash. There are some obvious trade-offs to this, and that could be in performance. And sometimes, you know, an interactive login password system may need some amount of better performance. And so there might be a need to use a different method. But these are these three that I've talked about, the PBK, DF2, Scrypt, and bcrypt, are just three examples of systems designed to actually hash passwords, versus the other method, which is where we invent something and then we apply some salt to it and hope for the best. These are actually fairly well used, and there are lots of libraries available that are compatible. So from that point of view, I think if you're designing a new system, you should look at a password hash. If you're trying to take an existing system that may use hashes or maybe not use anything, you're storing the passwords directly, definitely want to look at maybe using a cryptographic salt to help secure those password hashes.
Okay, well, I just wanted to quickly comment on the performance of these functions. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, it's going to take a second to generate these hashes. We're still talking about a fraction of a second. We're just trying to, these hackers or these table generators, they're trying to go as fast as they can, you know, billions of generating billions of hashes a second, and these password hashing functions may get them down to generating, you know, hundreds of thousands of hashes a second or whatever, and that's a huge decrease in the amount of hashes that they can generate a second. And I haven't tested the performance, or I mean, I know in your slides you have a slide of the performance, but I mean, for especially a small web application, I don't think there would be any performance considerations on this. I mean, Google, you know, may have some considerations when it comes to how many password users they can authenticate at a given time, but I don't think a small web application would have any problem with using a password hashing function.
Yeah, that's probably correct. You're right in that it raises the cost for the attacker by lowering the amount of the number of hashes they can generate in a given second. And they still have to compare quite a few hashes to find an original password. So yes, it performance wise, it's still really good performance from a developer point of view. It is less so from the attacker point of view, and that's really the goal here.
Okay, well, I will now talk about the last subject, which is the password cracking methods, which essentially kind of ties these two things together on why do we want to use SALT, why do we want to use, you know, the password hashing methods and things like that. And I'm just going to talk about the four main methods used to, if say you've got a list of password hashes, for example, the LinkedIn hashes LastFM or eHarmony hashes, what would you do to get the passwords out of them? And the first method, this is the method that, you know, is pretty much difficult to, or is the kind of the last defense method, is the brute force method. And this is basically just putting in passwords and hoping that what you put in will match what the hash is. This is like saying A, is that the password? B, is that the password? C, is that the password? You know, it's just trying every single combination of letters, numbers, and characters in order to get the hash. And this is what essentially password hashing is supposed to slow down. It's one of the things that it's supposed to slow down, because if a hacker can guess, you know, hundreds of billions of passwords a second, the length of time to brute force a password is going to significantly decrease than if they can just do 100,000 guesses a second. And that is the brute force method. And this is the method that you're hoping that a cracker will have to revert to in order to crack your password database. This is the essentially the last possible method of cracking a password database. Another method, somewhat related to the brute force method, is the dictionary method, and this is a method that essentially uses a dictionary of words, you know, English words, foreign words, common phrases, or whatever from, you know, popular TV shows or even the username of the user, or if you have, you know, other information about the user, for example, their birthday or address or things like that. It could use those as part of the dictionary. And this is essentially assembling passwords that the user could have used. This, if you use like a strong password or have a complexity requirement to your passwords, then typically this is what can protect your passwords from a dictionary attack. And past that, we have what is called a lookup table, and this is where basically a cracker will pre-compute the hashes for a hash type. For example, if in the case of LinkedIn, they were using SHA-1 hashes with no salt. So, you know, I'm guessing there's probably a lookup table for SHA-1 hashes with no salt out on the internet. And essentially all you have to do is you have a hash of a password. You essentially do a table scan of the hashes, and oh, look, there's the hash in this table. So we know what the password is since we've pre-computed it. And salting is a way to effectively defeat this method, and obviously if you use a unique salt per user, then you know you'd need an entire lookup table per salt. So that would essentially kind of make lookup tables a lot less effective. And rainbow tables, which is sometimes a term used interchangeably with lookup tables, they're actually different. They use an algorithm. They use hash chains, essentially, to make the lookups in a lookup table faster than essentially having to do an entire table scan of the lookup table. And those are, again, it's essentially a lookup table with an algorithm applied to it in order to increase the search time. Those, again, just like a lookup table, a salt will do a pretty significant job of defeating the rainbow table if you use it, you know, use the tips that Mike suggested. And obviously using a password hashing method would increase the amount of time it would take to generate these lookup tables, and could make it restrictively expensive to generate a lookup table for an entire hash method. So those are the four basic types of cracking methods for passwords that are used by crackers.
As you said, with the salting, the lookup tables and rainbow tables, that really helps defeat that. In the case of the dictionary attacks, that you know, as long as you have some complexity to your password requirements, it helps defeat that. And that's just what I wanted to point out. You can design a great system and be using the password hashing functions as Keith described, and have, you know, which are taking advantage of slow hashing and using good salts. But if you don't have any complexity requirements to your system, you know, if you allow any old password to be stored, for example, password, then it, you know, even though people are sort of reverted to using the brute force attack, you know, one of the first words they're going to try is password, and they're going to defeat all that additional security that you added in. So I just wanted to kind of comment on that part of designing a great system is not just making sure that you store the password securely and that you use these password hashing functions, but you should also be looking at how you store the password, having some complexity, having some length requirements to that, so that, for example, as you mentioned, Preston, brute force attack, you know, it's going to go through and it's going to do A, B, C, A, A, B, B. If you allow your password just be stored as one character and someone can store an A, then even though you've designed a great system, when it comes to the brute force attack, your user is then vulnerable to that very first attack that will take place.
Right, yeah, certainly. We have a challenge here, and I know we're talking specifically about hashing, but your point about complexity is well taken, because if we design a system that can allow any old password, well, people are going to use the simplest ones, and so making sure they don't do that is helpful. The problem is when we crank that complexity knob up too high and require users to use a very complex password, We're forcing them almost to go and write down passwords and stick them to their monitors too. And so that's one challenge. But really, given that every site you want to go to requires an account and a password, we already have this challenge industry-wide right now. And so I'm not sure. We keep talking about people should be using password database tools to manage all of this, but still there's something that needs to be said about this requirement of everybody needs an account and a password, and they all have to be different. They do, because we built systems where they don't talk to each other. We don't have any sort of centralized authentication service that would allow us to authenticate to these other services yet that we all trust. And, you know, trust is relative here in this case. So we're certainly not addressing that topic, but the fact that allowing users to enter passwords that are not complex is certainly something that a developer needs to keep in mind.
Okay, do we have any other comments on that topic or the whole discussion?
Well, I was going to mention one other thing. In people may wonder about rainbow tables, and they do require a lot of computation to generate a rainbow table, but there are several projects out there doing that, one of which is freerainbowtables.com, which is a distributed computation project specifically for rainbow tables, and they have several projects going on where borrowing CPU cycles from systems around the world, they are able to generate these rainbow tables. So if you think, well, the rainbow tables sound good, but you need a lot of people to generate them, well, there are a lot of people out there generating them right now. So they are a legitimate tool for attacking password hashes.
Okay, well, I guess we will wrap it up then. I wanted to thank Keith Watson and Mike Hill. It's Went With Sirius. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.